Hello and welcome back to RN Breakfast for Good Friday. I'm David Bush, sitting in for Fran and the team. Through the rest of Breakfast, we're exploring the world of non-biblical texts about the life of Jesus, how to incubate the potential of new Australian composers writing music for worship, and how poetry, spirituality and activism go together. Between now and 7, we're going to Canberra. It's celebrating its centenary this year, and we're visiting one of its newest and perhaps less noticed sites. The Australian Centre for Christianity and Culture is virtually in the city centre. It's on the shores of Lake Burley Griffin, just off the Kings Avenue Bridge, right next to the Australian Federal Police Headquarters, a stone's throw from Old Parliament House and the National Rose Garden, with a great view of the National Carillion, and on a pleasant walking route between the High Court, Federal Parliament and many federal departmental buildings. Indeed, the property is not fenced, and you'll sometimes see justices of the High Court, public service chiefs and politicians strolling through the open lakeside grounds. But don't expect a large cathedral or public building. Most of the Australian Centre for Christianity and Culture is open ground, with a large cross the only significant marker of this site. The site also includes a pilgrim trail, a labyrinth, protected grasslands, a natural amphitheatre, a garden of biblical plants, a modest conference centre and some offices. But the understatement of the site is just part of its rich symbolism. Recently I visited the Australian Centre for Christianity and Culture, and as I sat on a rock under some trees in the heart of the site, I spoke with its executive director, the Reverend Professor James Hare. So James, we are sitting in what is called the spiritual heart of the Australian Centre for Christianity and Culture. And it's not a church. What is it?
It's a fireplace. It's a fireplace which has been used by the indigenous population of this country for thousands of years. The fireplace is in the middle. There are 12 stones around it, representing completeness. That is, for example, in the Judeo-Christian tradition, it's the 12 tribes of Israel, the 12 disciples, but also has meaning in that way of completeness for the indigenous population. And we're sitting beside native grasses, which have been here since time immemorial, 2 hectares of them, which we preserve and which scientific research is carried on in, and there are 54 different species of insect who live there. So we're not inside a building. We are outside. We can see the hills 20 or 30 kilometres away, yet we're only 900 metres from our federal parliament. Now, this is the heart because it has Christian symbolism, but it also has strong indigenous associations. We hold our Sorry Day event here. This event is often attended by the minister representing Aboriginal issues, and many other people come, and they just come to gather round, and it's the indigenous people who take the running of what happens here. And on the day in which the former Prime Minister, Kevin Rudd, what he expressed in the expression of sorrow in the Parliament in 2008, the reciprocal service was held down here. After the statement was made in Parliament House, then the indigenous community came down here and they expressed reconciliation in terms of accepting the apology. They expressed forgiveness. And in a sense, forgiveness is the other half of saying sorry. But also the indigenous people come here to settle their own disputes. And they do what I very much like. They never ask permission to come onto our land. I would hate them to ask permission to come onto the land. And very much the land is used in 2 ways. We as settler population see it in one particular way. They see it in a completely different way. That makes no difference. They come here, they spend time frequently in the late afternoon, and they know how to look after the place. We don't ever need to mention anything to them. Indeed, we never interfere in what they do. And I always hope that will be that way. So it's really the ideal that we've had since Mabo and Wick, that there could be 2 ways of using the same land, 2, if you like, different worlds, but both with deep respect for the other and both with deep religious significance for both people. And that, for me, is really what the heart of this place is about. It's about people, not about buildings, and we have tried to put up our buildings in a way that they are respectful of the land. And we were determined from the beginning not to destroy the landscape, to make it, if you like, an Australian cathedral, maybe even a postmodern cathedral, a form of Christian expression which did not depend on Gothic architecture or the best of Europe or even the repetition of the best of Europe in the United States. So we would do it in our own way. Now, we've had the repetition of the United States in the development of the religious buildings in the state capitals, so that even in the Anglican Cathedral in Brisbane is the completion of the last Gothic cathedral, and that's because the states really developed in the 19th century. But Canberra didn't. Canberra is a 20th and 21st century town, and for that reason it needs to be developed in a more authentic and self-assured Australian way, which is not to repeat things of the past, but to do it in our own particular way. And in this country, doing things outside is more important than doing things inside. We don't want to see the buildings as dominating it. We want to see the land as dominating the buildings.
In fact, it's very striking. If another country, for example, had a national centre of Christianity and culture, you can imagine it being very developed and a huge building in a very impressive, showy place. Here it's very understated. In fact, the landscape and the ghost gums and the trees are the most dominant feature of this whole centre.
Yes, and I think that's part of what we hope our Australian spirituality and our Australian understanding is. We hope that both of our communities, Indigenous and non-Indigenous, feel confident in this country, and therefore we don't need to put up vast buildings which are monuments to ourselves. We are comfortable in this country, and after all, that's the way in which our Parliament building is built. It's built into the hill. And in fact, if we didn't have the large flagpole, you'd hardly notice the building. It's built into it. It has this idea, which is a very deep Australian concept, of the understated, of things happen, the country is run well, peacefully, but we don't need to point to ourselves very much. And that is also the way in which we want to express Australian Christianity in this site.
That said, there is some very profound and significant symbolism here, which again is a little understated, but when you realise it, you think that's pretty impressive. And I'm thinking, for example, of the two fir trees that are directly opposite us across the circle of stones. Tell me about those.
Well, at the beginning, when we were just getting the centre going, we had a ceremony in which we invited the Queen, who came here, to plant one of those trees. But at the same time, we invited Professor Loachie O'Donoghue, who has been a member of our council for many years, to plant the other tree. And this very much expresses our self-understanding here in Australia, that we ask the leader of the Indigenous community and the leader of the settler community to plant the trees together.
It was interesting that the Queen planted the black fir and Loachie planted the white fir, which kind of talks about empathy with the other.
That's right. It was very much that was very much in mind, that the Queen would plant the black tree and Loachie the white one, so there's a complete empathy with what they're doing. And it was extremely gracious of both the Queen to do it with an Indigenous leader and for an Indigenous leader to prepare to do it with the Queen. So it very much expressed, I think, the aspirations of this country.
This site also was the original Tent of Meeting. What's that about?
Yes, the Tent of Meeting, of course, is a symbol from the Old Testament. It also represents a place where there would be a meeting between Indigenous and non-Indigenous, between various parts of Australian society. We want this to be a meeting between religious people and secular people, and also the beginning of dialogue between Christians and Muslims, Christians and Jews, Christians and Hindus, Christians and Buddhists. It also was the place in 2000 from which the church leaders set out on their pilgrimage to Uluru, and they started here at this fire. So it was from here that they made a journey right through to Uluru, and that was a very significant occasion. And they went through disadvantaged and difficult areas, especially areas of tension between indigenous and non-indigenous populations, and they tried to bring healing in this journey of healing, which was felt to be very important.
You've talked about the indigenous spirituality of this place. Intriguingly, Walter Burley Griffin, who planned Canberra, was a theosophist. He thought this particular piece of geography was the spiritual heart of the city.
Well, that's very interesting. In the original Walter Burley Griffin plan, this is the spiritual centre, this part. And then a decision was made to give land to the churches to build their religious centres. And the giving of the land was to be based on the percentage of the population of the previous census. The Anglican Church had 40% of the population in the 20s, in the 1920s. They got the best site, it was this one. And the Presbyterians got their land, and the Catholics, and the Methodists, and the Congregationalists, and the Baptists. And in fact, after the war, land was given also to the Jews. The other churches built churches on their site. The Anglican Church did not. And then, very graciously, the land was held in the hands of the General Synod of the Anglican Church of Australia. They then handed it over to the local diocese, and the local diocese of Canberra and Goulburn handed the land over for the use of the Australian Centre for Christianity and Culture. And so, in a sense, it's come back to Walter Burley Griffin's original intent. That is, a form of Christianity and culture which is respectful of the other, including the indigenous and other faiths, which is respectful and tries to be genuinely Australian. If you come here and you're in spiritual need, and many people are, we're here and you can call on us, but if you simply want to walk the labyrinth yourself or walk round the pilgrim way or sit by the fire or contemplate in the Bible garden or sit in the shelters or sit below the cross or contemplate the indigenous mural wall of the Holy Spirit, you do that yourself. That's very much the Australian way. People will not interfere unless you want them to.
You've alluded to how this place sits in the fabric of Canberra as a city, and particularly as a seat of federal government. Yep. You're right next door to the Federal Police Building. Federal Parliament's less than a kilometre away. Old Parliament House is just around the block there. And from the view of the lake, where you're right on the shores of Lake Billy Griffin, you can see Defence Headquarters and a whole lot of other places. What sort of spiritual presence do you want this place to be for the seat of government, which is so frenetic and so full of the intrigue and necessities of power and decision-making?
What we want this place to be is to give the other picture of life. The danger in Canberra is that we tend to think that political activity, including political intrigue, and the search for power and the organisation of government is all that there is to life. Perhaps the best things in life have nothing whatsoever to do with the political process. The political process is necessary, but there is another side of life, and the other side of life deals with many of the best things in life. Ultimately, the relationship between the indigenous population and the non-indigenous is a spiritual relationship, because the indigenous population are deeply spiritual people, and the way of interacting with them is a spiritual way. So it's not simply service provision, as if they're objects to be dealt with. Rather, it's much more that we relate to them as human beings. That's something that's important here. Again, in our interfaith work, relations between Christians and Muslims, Christians and Hindus, Christians and Jews, and so on, the primary relation is one as human beings. And then we have to look at issues of discrimination, all those other kinds of issues. But they need to be seen in the wider context. It's difficult for parliamentarians to bring religious beliefs into the chamber. But in fact, religious beliefs often underlie why they're there. Not everyone's in parliament for cynical reasons. Certainly, I would say the vast majority begin with deep passion about something. It may be tempered by the cynicism of the political process, but the passion is still there. And therefore, it's good that there be a place where we engage intellectually and also engage in public discourse on the big picture, as we do every week with our conferences and other forms of academic work. And we also provide resources to the federal parliamentary and public service work here, which is done, I hope, in a very Australian way. We simply provide an understated way and let's see how people use it. But I think that kind of expression is an important part of the whole of life. Otherwise, we would end up as a kind of apparatchik system of fixers telling the rest of the country what's good for them. And that's certainly what this country stands strongly against. The point of this place is that it will be a resource centre. It will provide all those other parts of life, and I may say it's greatly used by parliamentarians and others, and it should be used in that way without seeking power. The understated Australian way is never to seek power. In other words, almost to run away from power. And when you run away from power, you find they want you.
Which is in contrast to what people may assume a major Christian presence in Canberra is designed to represent, and that is advocacy to yes. achieve traction on certain issues, particularly social issues, with a Christian agenda. Yep. You're nowhere near that game.
No, that's a futile game. There are lobby groups in this town, and of course the churches also lobby directly. My experience is that that lobbying does not have an enormous amount of effect. People with special interests, and of course members of parliament and senators, are constantly being lobbied from all sorts of commercial and professional interests. But if you are a group whom they seek out, rather than you seeking them, if they come to you and say, have you any advice on what we should do in this situation? And you give them a very considered opinion and give them four or five options and give them also the pros and cons of each option, then they're liable to listen to you if you're not trying to push a barrel. At the end of the day, they are elected by a majority of diverse people and therefore naturally have their antenna up against lobby groups, because they can never be seen to be sectional in their interests.
Raises what is effectively the other half or the other side of this place. We've talked about the spirituality of presence, landscape and symbolism and the openness of this place. But central to its existence is also a focus on public theology. Yeah. And there's a range of public theological institutes and movements and forums and things.
Public theology is the expression of Christianity for the community, rather than for the individual. We have, really since the Enlightenment, since the middle of the 18th century, said, well, religion is a private matter. Now, that partially is untrue and dishonest, because many of the things that we do are very public. Australia, probably more than any other country in the world, has a greater degree of church involvement in the provision of education, in the provision of hospitals, welfare services, retirement villages, all kinds of projects of that kind in our society. In fact, it's said that if you calculate in a particular way some of those areas, 54 cents in every dollar of public money spent in this area passes through the churches at one point or another. And therefore, public theology is being honest, saying that you want to have a public presence. Now, I think primarily public theology is similar to the work of the artist. The artist represents the things that we would all rather forget about. And therefore, I think public theology represents the political agenda that we'd like to bury, where the political process narrows something down to deal with and leaves other things unspoken of. Now, I don't blame Parliament for what it does. It's inevitable that it becomes narrowly focused, especially when the difference between the two parties in terms of numbers is very, very close and other agendas have to be raised. And that's the job of public theology. I'm very uncomfortable at the moment, as I'm sure many Christians are, at the way in which we are dealing with the issue of asylum seekers. After all, the history of the Old Testament, the history of Israel, the history of the Hebrew Scriptures, is one of asylum seekers. Jesus was an asylum seeker. At the heart of Christianity is this concept of being homeless. And we need to deal with that. Now, in our society, what we need is some major discussion that runs through from Afghanistan right through Southeast Asia, and especially including Indonesia, where the whole issue is dealt with. I'm not even sure that our political process has really found an answer. Another one is in relation to indigenous issues. Why do we get so hot under the collar on this issue? Is it because we have this kind of paralyzing shame about past injustice, or an incredible sense of inadequacy because we can't bridge the gap? We love to be a can-do country, and here we come up against cannot-do. And therefore, I think we need to look at this issue in a spiritual sense. These are examples of what public theology are about. So it's not simply about individual holiness, it's about social holiness. How do you do it together?
Some may regard even the existence of an Australian Centre for Christianity and Culture to be anachronistic and perhaps even slightly Christian imperialist. Should we be talking about an Australian multi-faith centre or an Australian inter-religious centre?
Yes, one could argue that in a certain sense. My own view is that because we are statistically the largest grouping in this country, representing one way or another around about 65 to 70% of the population, it's Christianity's responsibility to take the lead. Now, I served for many years in Indonesia, and in Indonesia, the Muslim community takes the lead. Completely appropriate. Here, I think that Christianity should take the lead, but we must be open. And therefore, a lot of our work is interfaith. We are in dialogue with Muslims and Jews, Hindus, Buddhists, and so on. A lot of that takes place here, and our next development actually is a center of inclusion. Its long title is A Center for Public Theology and Inclusive Societies. But we want it to be a place where people of all faiths and of none come and discuss their deepest needs, and all views are respected. And I believe that Christianity needs to take the lead, and I hope it does so in a very understated way. Our development here is we want to build this centre of dialogue, which for me is the most important part, and then we want to build a kind of great space for national religious occasions. For example, in Britain there's Westminster Abbey, which although Christian and Anglican, is really used by everyone. In Washington there's the National Cathedral. We don't have anything like that, and I think we need something of that nature for when things go very well for us and also when they're disasters. But it needs to be based first on this dialogue centre, this place where there are open ideas. And I simply feel that Christians, in the broadest ecumenical sense, need to take the responsibility just because we happen to be the majority community.
That's Reverend Professor James Hare, the Executive Director of the Australian Centre for Christianity and Culture, speaking to me on site on the shores of Lake Burley-Griffin, right in the heart of Canberra. And just a note that James Hare is leaving that position as Executive Director at the end of this year, but he will stay closely involved in developing that Interfaith Centre for Inclusion, which he spoke about. And today being Good Friday, the open spaces of the Australian Centre for Christianity and Culture are hosting an Ecumenical Stations of the Cross this morning at 11. If you're in the ACT or surrounds, you may wish to join in. It's for all ages, and the centre is in Blackall Street, Barton. I'm David Bush, and you're listening to RN Breakfast. News is next, and then, what about those texts that didn't make it into the New Testament? Is there a case for expanding the standard collection? A new book just out puts 10 additional texts alongside the usual 27 to make what the publisher calls a new New Testament. That's coming up. It's news time, 7 o'clock.